DW Deutsche Welle. Living Planet.
Hello, I'm Irene Quayle in Bonn. Good to have you with us.
ありとあらゆるものが目の前を流れていくんですが。
The tsunami came out of the sea like a huge black wall. It swallowed everything that was part of our lives. When I turned around, I saw boats flying through streets, houses floating away and cars piling up on one another. And then suddenly, white snow fell from the sky. It was absolutely surreal.
冷たくて本当に寒い夜になりました。
Five years ago, the world was shocked by the news that a massive earthquake had set off a devastating tsunami along the coast of Japan and triggered a meltdown in the nuclear energy plant at Fukushima. What does the region look like today? And...
Well, not only can we do a transition of our energy systems to truly sustainable systems, financially, economically, socially and environmentally sustainable systems, we're in the midst of it.
Fukushima gave a boost to the development of renewable forms of energy. How far have we come since then? More than 19,000 people were killed in the tsunami disaster that hit Japan 5 years ago. Entire villages were destroyed, and the nuclear plant at Fukushima went into meltdown. One of the world's most highly developed, high-tech countries had to admit that it was unable to prevent and struggling to cope with what was later deemed the world's second worst nuclear disaster after Chernobyl. German radio correspondent Jürgen Hannefeld has been to visit the disaster-stricken region. His feature was adapted for Living Planet by Natalie Müller and is presented by Sarah Steffen.
There are around 4 million seagulls here, screeching in the skies above Hachinohe at the northern tip of Japan's main island Honshu. It's the start of a new long-distance walking trail. The path runs through a newly established nature reserve and is supposed to cross three prefectures one day, from Aomori via Iwate and on to Fukushima, ending just before the destroyed nuclear power plant. 5 years after the devastating tsunami, which killed more than 20,000 people and literally shattered the entire coastline, this landscape is slowly recovering. But where the path descends down to the sea, there are still reminders of the great tragedy. A fishing boat washed 20 meters up a slope. It now serves as a memorial, a shrine on a cliff dedicated to the sea god. Yana Gisawa-san keeps watch over this special place.
This one is new. The old shrine was ripped up by the sea. Before the tsunami, a torii, a red entrance gate to the shrine, used to stand over there. Months later, it was pulled out of the sea in America, on the other side of the Pacific.
Looking out at the calm sea, reflecting beams of sunlight, it's hard to imagine such still water being the source of such violence. On the 11th of March 2011, a 9-magnitude earthquake struck off the coast of northeast Japan, triggering a tsunami, the likes of which locals had never seen before. Yuko Tano remembers it was cold but sunny, and the sky was clear and blue. It was the day her daughter celebrated finishing middle school, and also the day her son disappeared forever.
At lunchtime, all the parents and children were eating a feast together in the community center when suddenly the earth shook. We then went out to the sports ground because it was too dangerous to stay in the building.
Earthquakes aren't uncommon in Japan. Most people know what to do. Stay together and keep calm. But no one suspected that the real catastrophe was still to come. The earthquake destroyed the power supply in Yuriage, a town near the metropolis of Sendai. The 5,000 inhabitants heard no sirens, no news, no tsunami warning. A camera on the roof of the middle school recorded the moment at 2:46 p.m. when the disaster hit. A 9-meter tidal wave ripped through the town, uprooting everything in its path.
The tsunami came out of the sea like a huge black wall. It swallowed everything that was part of our lives. When I turned around, I saw boats flying through streets, houses floating away and cars piling up on one another. And then suddenly, white snow fell from the sky. It was absolutely surreal.
...790 people died on that day alone in Yuriage, including Yukutano's in-laws and her 13-year-old son, Kota. Kota's body was only found 2 weeks later beneath the rubble. Tano doesn't even have a picture of him. All the photo albums were washed away with her house. Many of the places the tsunami reduced to rubble have been leveled and prepared for reconstruction. But who still wants to live here? The same question is being asked in Naraha. The village lies around 120 kilometers, that's about 74 miles, south of Yuriage, and wasn't only battling with the tsunami. Its inhabitants were taken to safety after the nearby nuclear power plant Fukushima 1 exploded during the earthquake. Five years on, the place is buzzing, even if it's just this Saturday. Dozens of children romp around in the municipality's water treatment plant, while parents have their hands full trying to keep the little ones in check. Every now and then, friendly assistants holding megaphones pipe up with announcements.
Yes. Even the sand, which serves as a filter for the local river water, was replaced. There's no more danger from radioactivity in drinking water.
Naraha is just a short drive, some 15 kilometers from the ruins of the nuclear plant. It's one of seven towns in the area that were completely evacuated after the disaster. In September, Naraha became the first municipality in this restricted zone to be considered, quote, habitable again. Officially, at least. For the fourth time since the all-clear, the administration has organized a bus tour for families who may want to eventually move back to their former place of residence. Local official Hiroki Miura is responsible for the so-called revitalization of Naraha.
As a community, we obviously hope that all 7,400 citizens return to Naraha. For those who've settled down somewhere else, it's difficult, but our real goal is to get half the former residents back by next spring.
That's ambitious, given that so far only 440 people, or about 7% of former inhabitants, have decided to return. Almost all of them are older people. 93-year-old Kane Sato moved back into a farmhouse more than 2 years ago, even though it went against warnings from the authorities.
After the evacuation 5 years ago, they put me in a shelter. On the fourth floor, without an elevator. It was so exhausting at my age. This here is my home. I have photographs of my husband and my ancestors on the wall, and their graves are just outside. This is where I belong, and when I die, I'll be with them. That's important.
Her daughter-in-law, Noriko, also moved here to look after the older woman. Noriko says she spent her whole life in the area, and that at 53, she's also no longer so vulnerable to the radioactive radiation. Her husband earns money somewhere else. Her two sons are far away, and her six great-grandchildren are still so tiny, it would be dangerous for them to even come close to the exclusion zone. This reality moves the old woman to tears. Her daughter-in-law says they can't change their situation.
Our family, like most others here, has always lived with four generations under the same roof. Now we're spread over three different places, and there isn't really anything you can do about that.
Shoganai is the word in Japanese, an expression of deep resignation. At least Noriko has a small car, so that she can occasionally go out and buy things that are no longer available in the abandoned town, where most of the shops are still closed. But that means traveling 40 kilometers to get to the next big city. The area around Naraha is still a deserted exclusion zone. The town is essentially isolated, an island in radiation territory. The bus group this Saturday consists of 10 young families with 2 to 4 children. The tour comes to an end at the not-yet-complete primary and secondary schools, where lunch is being served. A 30-year-old mother of 3 says she already knows what her family will do.
We've already decided that we'll come back in March next year, when the schools open. I haven't really thought a lot about the radiation.
A man about the same age admits,
I always wanted to come back anyway, but I was just waiting on a signal from the government. I'd be lying if I said I wasn't afraid of radioactivity, but my desire to stay here again is stronger.
The authorities only want us to speak to people who are determined to return. But the clear majority of the group, 7 out of 10 families, say they've decided to stay away. Here's Makoto Ohashi, a father of 4.
Oh no, we are definitely not coming back. 5 years ago, we had to disappear, leave everything in a mad rush. Now, I've built a house somewhere else, with government assistance, by the way.
Miniko Takeuchi, a mother of 2 kids, says,
I only came along because I wanted to know what it looks like here today. I don't believe the government's data on radiation. What I've seen here has made me very sad.
By that, she probably doesn't mean the expensive, newly built public institutions popping up in Naraha, but the noisy construction sites in between. From a brand new, childless playground, you can see a huge tsunami protection wall that is still being built. And over endless heaps of black plastic bags full of radioactive waste. Apparently, there are 58,000 of them. Simply lying there, marked with warning signs. No one knows exactly where to put them. To motivate former inhabitants to come back, the government is using the carrot as well as the stick. Government assistance for nuclear refugees from Naraha runs out next year. So those who are still living in shelter accommodation will lose their place to live. Across Japan, an estimated 120,000 people are receiving subsidies, worth around 800 euros a month, and it's getting gradually more expensive for the state. In Naraha, there's plenty of vacant housing, the abandoned homes of those who'll never come back. 77-year-old Yoshiaki Yoeki stands alone before his farming property.
Look at my neighborhood. 18 houses, and only 6 of them are inhabited, and only with older people. There are no children, no parents. I'm less scared about the radiation than I am about the future. How much longer can this go on?
Yoshiaki Yoeki has always opposed nuclear power. When the energy company TEPCO built the Fukushima 1 power plant 45 years ago, he distributed flyers around Naraha in protest. When asked who's to blame for the current misery, he's quick to answer.
TEPCO and the government.
He's not alone. Prominent politician Naoto Kan agrees with the old farmer. But he only realized there could be a nuclear problem when it was too late.
Until the 11th of March 2011, I believed that a nuclear accident like the one in Chernobyl couldn't happen in Japan, because the quality of Japanese technology is so high. I had even recommended other leaders buy Japanese nuclear power plants. But when I realized that Japan was spared from the evacuation of 50 million people only because of the coincidence of wind direction, my opinion changed. In the interests of our children and grandchildren, and beyond that for all people in the world, we should renounce nuclear energy.
At the time of the disaster, Naoto Kan was serving as Japan's prime minister. But he's now become an ally of the environmental organization Greenpeace. In the past few days, their flagship Rainbow Warrior has been sailing along the Fukushima coast to protest against the Japanese government's inaction. With a small laboratory vessel, nuclear physicist with Greenpeace Heinz Smital has been measuring radioactive radiation in the sea of Fukushima.
We're combining an underwater recording we got with this underwater robot here with direct radiation and also gamma spectrometry and with sampling. The thing is that the radioactivity isn't spread as evenly as we think. Instead, there might also be hot spots in the water. Why that happens is something we want to look at in more detail.
There was more radioactivity in the sea during the Fukushima meltdown than at any other time in history. The fact that the water is still contaminated 5 years later shows just how complex the problem is. There's also a lack of reliable data, says Dr. Angelika Clausen of the group International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War.
So far, there's been a failure to create a comprehensive register for contaminated groups, a register for all the liquidators, for the evacuated population, and the contaminated population. There's also been a failure to have regular health checks, to collect basic data, which you can then use to conduct research. There can't be research without proper base data.
For example, separate studies mention 150 cases of thyroid cancer in children from Fukushima. But what's the norm?
Usually we find that there are 1 to 2 cases of thyroid cancer per million in children under 18. So this is, of course, a shocking statistic.
Insofern ist das natürlich eine erschreckende Zahl.
That the state and society seem to care so little about the victims of Fukushima may have something to do with the Japanese reflex, to repress and forget all things unpleasant as soon as possible. This was perhaps most evident when Japan put itself forward as host for the Olympic Games in 4 years' time. When submitting Tokyo's application for the 2020 Games 2.5 years ago, Prime Minister Shinzo Abe himself referred to the link between the nuclear disaster and the sporting event.
And may have concerns about Fukushima. Let me assure you, the situation is under control.
But Dr. Angelika Clausen doesn't agree.
Nein, die Regierung hat Fukushima nicht im Griff.
No, the government doesn't have Fukushima under control. Each day, hundreds of thousands of liters of radioactive water flow from the reactor's environs and into the ocean. That's why the government doesn't have it under control.
Dann hat die Regierung das nicht im Griff.
For his part, nuclear physicist Smital says,
das Kraftwerk ist nicht unter Kontrolle. Man kann
the power plant is not under control. You basically can't say where the nuclear fuel is.
Kernbrennstoff genau befindet.
Because no one dares to enter the reactors. A few kilometers away from the crippled nuclear power plant, the State Atomic Energy Agency is finalizing a model version of the structure, which they'll use to rehearse the demolition. Here's Chief Engineer Koji.
First, the technicians here will work out the best way to demolish the plant. Second, there are many experienced workers who aren't allowed to enter the real power plant anymore because they've already reached the maximum allowable radiation dose. They will train their less experienced colleagues here.
The Fukushima practice model cost Japanese taxpayers 680 million euros, or 750 million US dollars. Meanwhile, the problem is getting ever more pressing. Up to 8,000 men work on the real power plant each day. And with each encounter, they get closer and closer to their maximum life load radiation limit. Only 5 of the 40 years it'll likely take to dismantle Fukushima 1 at best have passed. And demolition hasn't even started yet. For the past 5 years, most of the workers have been busy building large tanks where radioactive groundwater can be stored. Every day, there are still hundreds of tons of water rushing through the lower floors of the reactors and mixing with the radioactive broth TEPCO uses to cool the reactors. Despite filtering, the water cannot be simply discharged into the sea. It has to be stored. Currently, the capacity is 850,000 tons, and the space for further tanks is shrinking. A wall of frozen earth to stop the flow of groundwater should help the situation, but even that's not working. A multi-million dollar flop.
Fukushima, 5 years on. That was Sarah Steffen with that feature, filed for Living Planet by Jürgen Hannefeld. The Fukushima disaster convinced the German government under Angela Merkel that nuclear power was not the way to go. The country decided to start phasing out nuclear energy and give financial support to the development of renewable energy technologies like solar and wind to replace the fossil fuels that are harming the climate. This helped to boost alternative energy production around the globe. So how far have we got in the last 5 years? Will it be possible for the world to get 100% of its energy from solar, wind, hydro and biomass in the foreseeable future? I put the question to Alexander Ox, Senior Director for Climate and Energy at the World Watch Institute, an environmental charity with branches around the world. I caught up with him during a recent visit to Bonn in Germany.
Well, not only can we do a transition of our energy systems to truly sustainable systems, financially, economically, socially, and environmentally sustainable systems, we're in the midst of it. There is no one global trend in that direction, but there's many places, municipalities, provinces, whole countries, regions now that are transitioning away from fossil fuels towards renewable ways of producing energy and smarter ways, more efficient ways of consuming, using that energy. So it is absolutely doable.
Can you give me some examples?
Of course. I mean, Germany has managed over the last 2 decades to transition away from fossil fuel. We have seen enormous growth rates of renewable electricity production. Beyond renewable electricity, for the whole energy system, we're seeing trends in Germany. You have the usual other suspects, Denmark, which has always been seen as a climate and sustainable energy champion. But it's not a trend that's any more restricted to developed countries. If you look at Costa Rica, if you look at really many places on all continents, you find very dramatic examples, transitions away from fossil fuel energy towards sustainable energy sources. It's not always at the federal level, at the level of nations, but often at sub-federal levels of communities and provinces. So we have a lot of really great examples now to follow. We have a lot of good best practices that have been achieved. We also have negative examples. We really need to learn from the experience and share that experience internationally.
So what about a country like China, the world's biggest emitter, huge population? How do you see the development there?
The development is very ambivalent, ambiguous, if you want so. On the one hand, you find a country that is quickly growing emissions, that has a strong growth impetus, understandably so, it's a developing country. But on the other hand, you have now a lot of efforts, state efforts, as well as supporting private industry efforts into efficiency. You have investments into renewables in China that are outpacing the investments in any other country of the world. You have China chairing the next G20 summit and really investing into the issues of reducing climate emissions, supporting sustainable energy. So there's a lot of good news coming out of China as well. And as in so many other countries, we are now in maybe the midst of a revolution, a political revolution there, but a technical revolution, a market revolution as well. And so that means daily change, daily investment of people working for one side or the other. And that's really remains to be seen how this is working out in the long run.
What about the USA? This is an election year. We are seeing a lot of changes. We have seen some setbacks in terms of climate policy after the huge successes of the Obama administration.
If we talk about the United States, there is not one US player. Unlike many other countries where there is a consensus across parties, across people of different ideologies, that consensus does not exist in the United States. It's a highly partisan issue. Candidates now for the presidency as well as for the U.S. Congress take positions almost exactly along party lines, with Democrats very much in favor of climate protection, very much in favor of more sustainable ways to produce energy, more efficient ways to use energy, support of poorer countries on climate adaptation, support for international cooperation. And you do not find that on the Republican side, with the exception of a few candidates who are not front runners. So the results of the election on the federal level, as well as their impact for international cooperation on climate and energy, is very dramatic. Having said that, there is going to be, even under Republican leadership, which would have, again, dramatic impacts, there will be many actors in the United States that will continue their action on the ground, whether that's municipalities, more than 1,000 mayors are supporting the Kyoto goals, for example, widely unnoticed by Europeans, or whether it's on the state level, or whether it's on the level of really individuals. So you do see a lot of change happening on the ground in the United States as well. And I find it often very unfair for these people, if we look at the United States and reduce it to a presidency, which currently is strongly in favor of climate protection, but that might change if the presidency is won by Republicans.
So overall, how optimistic are you that the Paris Agreement could be put into effect and that it could really keep global warming to the targets of 2 to 1.5 degrees within the timescale necessary to avert catastrophic climate change?
If I look at the results of Paris, it leaves me rather optimistic, but nothing's won yet. The actions really need to happen now. Now, the so-called national contributions of individual nations, if you sum them up, you get to a warming still in this century of about 2.7 degrees Celsius if all the suggested changes are really implemented. What happened in Paris is really that a framework was set for action, and that was important, but the action still needs to happen. And needs to happen in every sector of our economies, and it needs to happen on every level of political decision-making, or if you want so, from the individual who makes lifestyle changes all the way up to new agreements in terms of international cooperation between countries. So on every single level, we need to produce change quickly, decrease emissions, and those actions have to happen now.
Alexander Ox from the World Watch Institute, talking to me there in Bonn. And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Living Planet. Remember, you can download episodes or replay them online at dw.com/environment, where you can also read up on other environment stories in and behind the news. You can also listen to our stories on iTunes and on SoundCloud. I'm Irene Quayle. From all of us here in Bonn, studio director Ileana Ghiaducci and sound wizard Gerd Georgi, until next time, bye for now.